Hey there, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Just a few days ago, President Trump and the co-leaders of the public-private COVID-19 vaccine effort, known as Operation Warp Speed, delivered a press conference to update the public on their efforts, particularly in light of the fact that the COVID-19 vaccine candidate produced by Pfizer is set to be approved under an emergency use authorization at the end of this month. Trump and the other speakers praised Pfizer as standing among one of the, quote, greatest companies anywhere in the world, and repeated the claim that Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine candidate was 90% effective. However, those efficacy rates are self-reported results presented to the public by Pfizer itself, and they have yet to be subject to public scrutiny. But this hasn't kept mainstream media or government officials from uncritically repeating the claim, as they have long promoted the vaccine as magically heralding the end of the coronavirus crisis. Meanwhile, we have officials in the U.S. like Dr. Anthony Fauci now openly claiming that the vaccine will not bring back any semblance of normalcy, as mask wearing and social distancing are to remain necessary, even if a majority of people choose to receive the vaccine. All of this, together with the fact that there has been so little interest among the media in asking any critical questions of Pfizer, a corporate behemoth with a lengthy list of horrific and even deadly scandals, gives more than enough cause for concern. To discuss this and more, I am joined today by Johnny Vedmore. Johnny is an independent investigative journalist and musician from Cardiff, Wales, whose work aims to expose the powerful people who are overlooked by other journalists. He is a contributor to Vocal Media and also to my site, Unlimited Hangout, where he will soon be publishing an investigation regarding Pfizer and its COVID-19 mRNA vaccine. So thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Whitney. I'm happy to be here. It's very exciting.
Absolutely. So what can you tell us about Pfizer as a company, and why should we be concerned about their COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, we're stepping into the great beyond with this one. There's a lot of confusion with mRNA vaccines because lots of people are mixing up DNA vaccines with mRNA vaccines, and they work slightly different. Well, very different. One, DNA vaccines actually alter your DNA, where an mRNA vaccine will alter a process that your DNA goes through. So one of the processes along the way to create a protein messenger. That's what the M stands for in mRNA. It basically, it's RNA is a something that mRNA is something that sends messages to which proteins need to be produced for the DNA. Now, DNA is quite a small molecule. mRNA is quite a big molecule. So for mRNA to be able to do that process, it has to break in half, which it does naturally. And this is what there's a lot of concern about, people believing that, you know, that's a process that the vaccine causes. But in actual, it breaks in half, so it can fit through to send messages to get the right protein to come and be delivered. Now, the way it does that is that the DNA breaks in half down the middle, you could say, and it goes through a very small gap. And on the other side, the mRNA then joins with that half-severed piece of DNA. The complementary strands join up, and they allow for messages to be sent for which protein to be produced. So that has to be understood right at the beginning. mRNA does not change your DNA. It changes a function of your DNA, a function that your DNA naturally goes through to increase proteins. But this is a new world. This is the beginning. This is mRNA is like the stepping stone towards much more major gene therapy. So we're entering into this, what could be described as a brave new world, because as soon as you're editing genes or doing anything, editing the process of genes in this case, so you're not editing the genes themselves, but you're editing something that the genes do at one process during the bodily's function. That is a massive change in the way medicine works. It of course enters into the idea that if mRNA vaccines work, then the most positive case would be vaccines for cancer, vaccines for diabetes, vaccines for Alzheimer's or dementia eventually. You know, this is a technology that could be really big if it works.
Well, you know what, though, is that the technology's been around for, what, like a decade or so, and they've been trying to take one to market, and it's never been proven to work. It's never been shown to be effective. It's never been taken to market before.
The interesting thing, the FDA have never approved any mRNA vaccination, and it's been about 15 years that mRNA and DNA vaccinations have been worked on really heavily. And I mean, the technology has amazing potential, but no one, not anyone, I can tell you the process that the basics of what the process of what an mRNA vaccine does, or the process of what a DNA vaccine does, but no one knows what the long-term impact is going to be on people's health, because this is messing with parts of our genetic code in all in this case, the messages that our genetic code sends to receive proteins, and that is a massive step, because that is the first step into the world of transhumanism, really.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that one of the leading bodies, sort of developing a lot of these transhumanist technologies, the Pentagon's DARPA. They're actually behind a lot of those vaccine technologies, whether it's DNA, well, both DNA and mRNA vaccines. Inovio Pharmaceuticals, for example, their DNA vaccine technology platform, originally funded into existence thanks to DARPA, and the same with Moderna's mRNA vaccine, and I believe, I may be wrong though, that Pfizer's mRNA vaccine uses something quite similar to what Moderna uses, no?
Yes. Moderna and Pfizer were, I think they already knew right at the start that this was the time for them to push through a technology that had never been approved before and get human trials for it. Because so many companies have been researching it for such a long time that they have to push for it now. So this is a perfect opportunity for them to push that out. Moderna and Pfizer were the two. Moderna, at the beginning of the year, was a leader in mRNA vaccine technology by far. There was no one else anywhere near them, but it was the acquisition of BioNTech by Pfizer that put Pfizer as at the front runner, because that company, that small German company, well, you say it's a small German company, but that's only in comparison to a behemoth like Pfizer or GlaxoSmithKline or Moderna. It's actually quite a small very specific technological biotech company that works for not just it kind of like it picks its partnerships very closely. So in 2019, before the pandemic hit, it was already working with Bayer. It was working with GlaxoSmithKline, I think, Eli Lilly, and some other companies. They were already having like these very specific partnerships with big companies, and they already had a partnership with Pfizer working on mRNA technology at a very low level. But once the pandemic hit out, Pfizer obviously realized, well, we need to get on top of the mRNA technology, otherwise Moderna will own the show. And so they went straight in for BioNTech and linked up with them very early on. And that was obviously that's proven to be a winner, though even today, Moderna have announced that their vaccine was 95% effective rather than the 93%.
More self-reported results.
yes, indeed. It is definitely the competition between these two big mRNA methods, by Moderna and one by Pfizer with BioNTech. It's quite interesting. Pfizer first entered into the vaccine race probably about, I think it was about 2006. They purchased a company called PowderMed. Well, and that wasn't an mRNA vaccine company. That was a DNA vaccine company. So you can already see the first move that Pfizer took into the vaccine market, the very first moves, were looking at DNA vaccines. So they know where they want to be eventually. Eventually, they want the rights to change your DNA. Eventually, that's what's going to happen. That's not what's happening now. And the mainstream media and other people will use that misunderstanding that people have about what an mRNA vaccine is and what a DNA vaccine is, literally to persecute people and prosecute people, because they're actually trying to put through laws at the moment in Britain. Keir Starmer, I think, he announced either yesterday or the day before that they were going to look to legislating for people who say things like, oh, it's going to change your DNA permanently, you know, fake news, that's fake news. Well, no, it's a step towards that. It's rather, it's going to change a function of your DNA. And then later on, they're hoping to obviously go the full way, because DNA vaccines is then, you know, do you want to be blonde? Do you want to have blue eyes? Do you want to see even more perfectly than you do? Do you want to live forever?
Wow, wild. Well, you know, a lot of this that's going on right now in terms of targeting so-called anti-vaccine propaganda has really kicked into high gear to a large degree. I mean, I just published about this last week about how GCHQ and their partners in the Five Eyes Alliance have essentially declared what the Sunday Times called cyber war against sites that they deem produce quote-unquote anti-vaccine propaganda, which of course is a very slippery slope, because a lot of people that have been accused of being anti-vaccine are actually just critics of, you know, a lot of these corporate, large corporations that have never been held accountable for anything, and have had, you know, a series of scandals and related to their vaccines. And of course, not being held accountable means that those problems are not rectified and that those abuses continue, right? So, you know, it's definitely a very slippery slope. But now a lot of these tools that GCHQ and some of these other groups are using were originally used to fight so-called propaganda of ISIS or the Islamic State online, and now they have turned it onto anti-vaxxers. And at the same time, in the UK specifically, there's been a group of people that are actually connected to the counterterrorism task forces in the UK who have been trying to paint a prominent critics of the big pharma, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Children's Health Defense and some other sites, trying to paint them as national security threats, which is a very disturbing pivot when you consider that these tools previously used for ISIS are now being turned on people who are critical of the vaccine industry.
Yeah, and you will find, and this is a really, I've got a really good example for this now, you will find that the people involved in all of those will have links to both Pfizer and to the media quite heavily, because that's who they use. So I think it was yesterday the BBC published an article called Vaccine Rumors Debunked, Microchips, Altered DNA and More. And they first claim, oh, you know, this crazy lady who's online and has some sort of, like, you know, following, she believes that Bill Gates is going to put a microchip in your arm if you have the vaccine, and that's not true, so that's one of the false ones, and it doesn't altered DNA claims, it's all lies. But if you actually look at the person that they talked to during the article from Pfizer, you get to a guy called, what's his name, Andrew Widger. And Andrew Widger, who works for Pfizer as their senior director of global media relations and has done for 8 years, was previously at the BBC as head of special projects and head of communications. So this is how they do it. They've already implanted 6 years ago, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, when they're thinking out these projects, they already are planting BBC journalists, with journalists. I say that with big quotation marks, massive, enormous comedy quotation marks. they implant these journalists and these expert communications and special projects type of people within companies like Pfizer and etc., where they know that he's been there now for 14 years. So he's there at the front saying, oh, look, this is all lies, you know, this is all fake news. And the BBC lap it up and use him. Pfizer's spokesperson, Andrew Widger, said the company vaccine do not alter the DNA sequence response of the human body. It only presents the body with instructions to build immunity. But see, they very carefully word these things to say it doesn't alter the DNA sequence. No, it doesn't alter the DNA sequence because DNA splits in half at one point, and then to require proteins, when it requires a certain protein, it splits in half like a strand of DNA. It's so it can fit through a hole that it can't normally fit through. Because the messenger DNA, the messenger RNA, it's so such a large molecule, which is why it's so unstable and needs to be stored at really, really low temperatures, that it can't fit through that hole to go and meet the DNA. That's why the DNA splits in half and joins with the mRNA. Now, that process is what I personally am complaining about. I don't want that process happening inside me when you don't know what's going to happen in the long term. And of course, Pfizer is a company that has never taken accountability for its actions and for its past disasters, and they are big disasters.
Well, why don't you expound on that a bit, if you don't mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem with Pfizer. Is that they have a history. They in 1996 they had a really big disaster happen, which was of their own making, in Nigeria, in the northern Nigeria, in Kano State, in the main city, which is called Kano, and there was a malaria outbreak there at the time, along with other things, you know, TB, etc. But they used that as a cover to come in and try their new drug that they were testing, experimental drug called Trovan, which, of course, because it's an experimental drug that they didn't really, you know, hadn't been tried properly before. They said afterwards that they tried it on a certain amount of Americans, but probably in much lower doses and probably to adults, because these Nigerian experiments were on children. They chose 200 children, many of them young, including I think about 3-4 years old, etc., who had malaria, and they split the 200 into two trial groups. One they gave Trovan, and the other they gave the equivalent at the time. I can't quite remember what the name of the, I say the equivalent. It was the number one on the market. It had been proven to be better in trials than Trovan. It was already there. They already owned that, I believe. So they had no real reason for having this secondary product. It didn't make too much sense why they were trying to build it up when there was already a good enough version out there, or the best version, a better version out there. But they skewed the trials by giving the other 100 a lower dosage of what the normal malaria drug that they would get. So these parents were coming with their kids, and the experimenters the Pfizer people weren't explaining they were in a trial. They had no idea that their kids were part of the trial. They thought they would just be getting the malaria medication that they would have got in full dosage, that they were gonna, that 100 of the children were gonna get in the one sample group. After the court case, Pfizer accepted and admitted that 5 children had died from the one sample group and 6 children had died from the other sample group because they weren't being given enough of the medication to save them from malaria, or to protect them from malaria, because they were low dosing it so that they could make Trovan look better statistically, for marketing purposes, obviously. The big problem, and the reason why they are even more culpable for this and how they did even more damage, was when they started the trials, they were supposed to, after 5 days, take blood samples from the children. Now, if they saw any abnormalities in test results, then they would switch over. They were supposed to switch over the children to the full dose medication, the normal malaria drug, so that they could fight off any potential long lasting symptoms. But they didn't bother doing those tests after 5 days, they could have done those tests. It wasn't like the Nigerian city of Kano didn't have the ability to do simple blood tests. They just waited until they saw irreversible symptoms coming out in the children before doing it. So instead of like bothering doing the tests, they waited for children to become crippled and brain damaged, scarred for life, and unable to look after themselves completely. And then once they realized that they had been responsible for all of this murder and the crippling of children, they got out of there really pretty quickly. They didn't do any follow-up examinations. They didn't do any care. They just left it like that, tried to run away and pretend it just never happened. They didn't have approval from any of the parents. They didn't have any written approval. And it was only later that Nigeria, and with the help of two fantastic, I can't remember what their names are, fantastic independent lawyers. Well, I say independent lawyers, but they basically worked on the case for the Nigerian people whose children had died, and some who had been affected. It took 10 years to get a settlement for Pfizer. That settlement was $75 million, and each of the families of the people would receive $175,000, I believe it was. The lawyers were Etigu Uwo, from Nigeria-based lawyer, and Richard Ashlusha, who's a Connecticut-based lawyer. And the latter guy, he says that that John Lacar's The Constant Gardener was based on this Nigerian Kano State affair. Of course, they swapped the place with being Kenya and swapped the drugs from being a malaria drug to like a HIV drug or something along those lines in the story to distance it enough from Pfizer so they wouldn't get prosecuted. But Pfizer spent 10 years in court denying, and trying to basically avoid any accountability. They used smear tactics. They used lots of scare tactics as well to try and put people who were part of the case. They just did not want to. They're a company who systematically doesn't want to accept responsibility for their actions. They ended up issuing a statement in 2007 entitled like Trovan Kano State Civil Case Statement of Defense. And they said that, you know, the mortality rate of the patients treated in Pfizer was historically lower than any African, or it was meningitis epidemics, but meningitis, malaria, and TB was going on at the time. So I do apologize. It was a meningitis drug. And no unusual side effects unrelated to meningitis were observed after 4 weeks. So their statement kind of said, well, it worked. It worked. It's fine. It helped them, even though they died and they were crippled and et cetera. And they gave her the pittance. The $75 million is a pittance, and $175,000 for each of the families affected was a pittance. But they put even another layer on top for those families to claim that $175,000. They put an obstacle in their way. They said, you have to let us DNA test you, so that we can prove that you're related to the deceased. And now that meant a lot of these African people in northern Nigeria were poor, they were uneducated, they didn't understand what DNA tests were, they didn't understand the process, they didn't understand why they needed them, and they thought that they were just trying to test on them, experimental drugs on them. So some families pulled out of the and didn't receive the settlement at all. I know. And the reports, like I say, they took responsibility in court, saying that, took responsibility in court. They accepted the payout included for the deaths of five children from the one sample and six children from the other sample group. But on things like the Wikipedia page and some Nigerian press, they say 50 children died out of the 200. they say it wasn't just the 11. 50 children died, and the rest were crippled and brain damaged, etc.
Well, this is really alarming to me, because one of the justifications Pfizer allegedly used in justifying them cutting all of these corners in this particular trial you're talking about was speed. That speed was of the essence. And now we are in Operation Warp Speed, which skipped animal trials for their, you know, experimental vaccines. Yep. And, you know, has also cut lots of corners using speed as the justification. And last month, a lot of people have forgotten this because of the 90% effectiveness reporting. But it did come out last month that Pfizer was recruiting and had already recruited several 12-year-olds to participate in their vaccine trials. So they are again testing on children, but this time in the United States, not in Nigeria. And it's worth pointing out that the FDA and this Nigeria scandal that you just went over had started to investigate Pfizer, but then mysteriously called off their investigation. And now we are at a point in the U.S. where the emergency use authorization for their vaccine is set to be issued by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA. And one of the most prominent people involved in that process at the FDA is the acting director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, Patrizia Cavazzoni, I believe her name is. And she used to be Pfizer's vice president for product safety, oddly enough. So
I wanted to get in deep into Cavazzoni, and I thought, wow, Patrizia Cavazzoni. She sounds like a beautiful, tall, wonderful, gorgeous woman who walk in the place and could convince you of anything. Then I went and looked at what she was like, and she was like, I don't know, she sounds like she's probably from like northern Germany or somewhere. She's like really softly spoken, and she's. And I was like, ooh, that's completely different from the name. That's I have further investigations on other things that include those players. So I won't say too much about that at the moment.
Well, I will say though, since I did write a little bit about her a bit ago, when she was Pfizer's vice president for product safety. She was involved in covering up the tie of a Pfizer product, Zoloft, an antidepressant, its ties to birth defects, which I believe resulted in a class action lawsuit being filed against Pfizer at one point for that. And during that also rather protracted court case, Pfizer attempted to keep Cavazzoni from testifying under oath about Zoloft and about its ties to birth defects, suggesting that there was perhaps something to hide. So it's quite disturbing, I would argue, that she is in a very prominent position where Pfizer is set, you know, is very much expecting to be just rushed through approval. Because, you know, last month they started already manufacturing hundreds of thousands of doses, which is not something you would do unless you are quite certain that your product will be approved and soon be allowed to be sold on the market.
Well, this is the thing about mRNA technology, and you know, while I'm all for the idea of putting good technology at use within medical care, and I'm all for the idea of a new technique if it works, as long as there's no negative side effects. This is quite a good technique, because what it allows someone to do when they're creating a vaccine for it, they don't have to go through so many of the processes normally. All they have to do is know the genetic makeup of the virus or the thing that they're trying to attack, so they know what proteins are being targeted by that virus, and then they can make this, tailor make it, as long as they have the genetic information, which was released, of course, by I think the Chinese version of the CDC in January. So there's already this it's already ready to be implemented and made so quickly when it's using an mRNA method, and that's part of the reason. But that idea of speed, and especially when it's a lot of things that you said, that little bits and bobs that I want to say about, because for instance, within the mainstream media, what they're saying at the moment is one of the falsehoods people around is saying that mRNA vaccines have never been tested on humans before. And they get to say, oh, that's false, because these things go through a first phase trial and a second phase trial. So we're on a third phase trial. So it must have been tested before. And they know perfectly well that a lot of the beginning trials were skipped. They were skipped very quickly. Nearly all of the vaccine trials went to the second stage with basically no problem. One of them, like all of the monkeys died or whatever. they were all very sick, and they were like, "Okay, next phase."
That's wild.
I know the fact that they've skipped these through, and then they'll use it later to say, "Oh, well, no," because what happens is that these things go through trials, so it has been tested on humans. And what you mean, the test that you're talking about, the phase three trial that you're talking about. So it's all right to try these on humans because we're doing it, is what the actual
But some of these earlier stages, well, I know for Moderna, for example, they had their big publicity blitz saying, our vaccine works. So it was a month or two ago. But the sample size of that trial was 8 people.
Sorry. I laughed so loud there, but it's hard not to.
I'm right there with you.
I just released an article on Vocal, the guys you mentioned not so long ago, which studied someone who was doing experiments on young girls who went through forced abortion, rape, some terrible things in this care home. They were really vulnerable, and they were being tested. Someone was testing drugs on them, drugs that have never been tested before, with links to the big boy GlaxoSmithKline. And they were using a sample group of 10 girls split into two. So 5 on the one side, 5 on the other. And I don't know what you could possibly learn from that. Surely someone should intervene and say, well, it's not worth the risk and the ethical questions surrounding whether these trials are actually worth taking if the sample size isn't going to give us any information at the end of the experiment. So these low sample sizes is something that I've seen, I've come across in my research before. Also talking about Pfizer and the way it works. I mean, you were talking about that lady Patricia. They churn through problems. They don't face problems. They make it look like they face problems when they have to, when it's right at the end. So, for instance, there was a point where they were in a scandal with a drug. I think it was Maraviroc. It was called, and it was what the Maraviroc scandal was with Pfizer was they illegally pre-marketed the HIV drug. I don't know quite what illegally pre-marketed, but it turned into a scandal. It was about 2006, 2007. It turned into a scandal, and they were like, okay, we're going to get rid of we're going to publicly fire 3 of our top executives. So they got rid of their like assistant sales manager, this woman, Kelly Fitzgerald. And this is what I mean. She currently works at Pfizer as the assistant sales director, I think, now. So she, even though she was publicly fired in 2006, 2007, they leave a couple of years to die down because they don't give a damn about accountability.
No.
They're like, oh, yeah, okay. And then now you look like you've been punished. Let's get you back. Let's get you back working.
Wow. Well, that's quite telling about the culture of lack of accountability. And also what you mentioned about the small sample sizes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really want to compare directly Pfizer to the CIA, but there was a CIA scientist back in the, I think, the 60s and 70s who's been written about by Doug Valentine, and I'm blanking on his name a bit, but he was one of the people involved in sort of LSD experiments for the CIA to see what would happen. But in one case, he just a random woman on the street with a baby in her arms, he dosed. And
oh my God.
She had quite a horrible time. I ended up committing suicide, I believe, a few years later as a result of that. So, you know, it's almost like some of these scientists, when they know they will not be held accountable and, are preying on vulnerable people, they seem to just not really care so much about the actual science of it in terms of like sample sizes or whatever, but just more of a, you know, I don't even know what to describe it.
Well, I think we've got to accept that the mad scientist archetype exists and has existed throughout history. You know, there are people who think that what they're trying to achieve is much more important than one or two people who get in the way. So the guy I wrote about who was had a sample size of five on each, in each group of these vulnerable girls who all had different ailments and all had different issues, were all like some were schizophrenic, some were brain damaged, etc. He was doing that for prestige. You know, he was doing that so he could become famous in some way, shape or form. He thought he was on the right path. And so the ends justified the means. This is what these guys do.
Oh, man. Well, moving on a little bit, I wanted to ask about some things going on in the UK right now as it relates to vaccines, because as far as Operation Warp Speed goes, at least at this point, it appears... of course, this may change, that it's going to be left up in the U.S. to different state governments whether or not a vaccine becomes mandatory, or if it is voluntary or whatever. But in the U.K., I understand that the Minister of Health, Matt Hancock, was speaking recently and said that there will be, his words, hope injected into the arms of millions before Christmas, which I found quite an interesting use of words. We've gone from selling people with deceptive political messaging in 2008, you know, with Obama, the hope and change. Now we've gone from deceiving people with hope to injecting them with it. So I was wondering exactly what the situation is with that sort of vaccination policy in the United Kingdom.
Matt Hancock. Matt Hancock. Ham-faced. I'm sorry. I've got to be a little bit... I know he must hate me, because anybody who retweets one of my articles like tags him into it every single time. Like anybody who does. He is a Tory. The Conservative Party over here, and this is the dynamics over here, is very interesting, because we did have someone who could potentially have resisted such movements, which is who was conveniently attacked under the fake guise of being an anti-Semite when his criticism was of Israeli war crimes.
Right.
He was Jeremy Corbyn, of course, who was a lifelong campaigner for not only civil rights and against like anti-apartheid movement, not against the anti-apartheid, he was part of the anti-apartheid movement. He was always out there seeking rights for people in the Jewish community, Muslim community. You know, he fought against the Iraq War, etc. He said he was one of the only lone voices who now, like, people look back on and go, oh, he was really right about that. Oh, but it's not hard to be right about that. You know, it's very telling that there was only one or two people who were actually standing up against this, the war on terror malarkey. Well, the dynamics in Britain are very interesting because they pushed out Jeremy Corbyn quite conveniently before, literally just before all this happened. I mean, he got ousted in the election that happened in December, which had been preceded by so much anti-Corbyn rhetoric, etc.
It was extreme, course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable. And listen, I hate the political system we have over here, and I have hated it for a long time because it's obviously not fair. It's archaic. It does not represent people. The House of Commons is not filled with common folk. The original meanings of what our institutions, both in Britain and America, what they were meant to mean, nowadays is just a sham, and it's just terrible. So I didn't really want to have to support Jeremy Corbyn. I was so disenfranchised by about 2013, 2014, that any politician could do anything good in this system. I was so away from that that it really was hard for me to accept Jeremy Corbyn in the first place, because I was like, he's just another one. But then he was just another one, but in comparison to the other ones, he was much better. And so he would at least stand up for certain things. However, when he got into power as leader, he didn't stand up for anything. And he just took attack after attack.
About a spine of wet cardboard, sort of, not unlike Bernie Sanders in the US.
I see that his advisors had advised him to not react to this new kind of nicer form of politics. But that's not going to work against the nasty people. They'll just destroy you if you do a nicer form of politics in that silly political system, which is nasty anyway. It's built on a nasty system. It's built on, a theatre, no, not theatre, a pantomime. It's all fake and silly. So there was nothing he was going to be able to do. It was depressing to support him, Corbyn. But eventually it was like, maybe this could be the change. Now they eventually got him out and they replaced him with someone called Keir Starmer. Now Keir Starmer used to be he's a really interesting person to coincidentally be in power at this time, because he used to be chief prosecutor in the UK. So I think he handled CPS and stuff and decided which cases went through and which cases were dropped and etc. And he was someone who protected Jimmy Savile at the end of his life. So when there was prosecutions being put forward to him about Jimmy Savile, he was not interested in.
He sounds a bit like Kamala Harris then, in that sense, who was sort of top cop in California, prevented the appeal of Sirhan Sirhan.
Very convenient that these people happen to be in office during this time when they want to change all of the laws. So these legal professionals who have been, because he was a barrister for years, a QC or however, Queen's Counsel. What interests me before as well is that I did an article on a woman who's basically a paedophile enabler who defends people like Rolf Harris and stuff. She's a barrister named Barbara Hewson. She's an unbelievable woman. I did I went into her family history all the way back to the 1500s, and I went through each generation of her family to see if the traits the traits that came out in her, the completely contrarian, over the top contrarian type of person she was, came out in any of her former genetic line. And they did. It's every generation was fighting against something really weird. Like it would be a Protestant fighting on the side of the Catholics after their mum was dug up and hung the dead body by papists just years before, and someone who just shot a maid for no reason while she was just putting stuff in the kitchen, and people who do her father was terrible and awful, etc. Have I gone too far away? Keir Starmer, before he became leader of the opposition, head of Jeremy Corbyn, even though we kind of all knew he was going to be him, very early on, he did a lot of podcasts with her. with Barbara Hewson, and he seemed to always revolve in these circles, which were the same circles as protecting paedophiles during the massive Jimmy Savile scandals and beyond. So, I mean, he's a really interesting, and his focus has been on changing the law, making legislation, and pushing the government to introduce laws that are, of course, dystopian, like the idea that if you misunderstand and say something that you misunderstand, then you will be like criminally prosecuted for it. Because this is what one of the points of the article I'm writing at the moment, oh, I've nearly finished, is that mRNA and DNA vaccines are really easy to mix up. It's really easy for people who don't know. And it's been a failure of all of these governments, all of these scientific advisors, and all of these pharmaceutical companies. It's been a failure of them articulating how these vaccines work that causes a mistrust. It's their inability to articulate that's a problem.
Well, not even just that, though. I think it also has to do with the lack of transparency, right? So, like, in the U.S., Operation Warp Speed is ridiculously secretive, and it's run by the military, it's run by the Department of Homeland Security, and the NSA, right, who you wouldn't expect to be running the vaccine effort. You would expect the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the civilian health agencies, or HHS to have the leadership role, but it's 90% dominated by the national security state. And they won't release hardly any information at all. And what they have released is incredibly redacted. So obviously that's not going to foster public trust. Right. But if you don't trust them, you're a baddie, basically, is where we're at now.
I would expect that. I suppose if I hadn't spent the past fair few years now researching these people, I would expect it to be handled by the CDC and other things. But I'm not surprised they're being handled by national intelligence community structure, because this is a takeover. The takeover is intelligence. Intelligence people who are trying to control every aspect of our life in every different way, through lobbying, threats, compromat, and many other things. And we know what's happening. But the useful part of that, for instance, they're not being tackled by the right agencies that you would expect. That allows us to say to people, normal people on the street who have been calling people like us conspiracy theorists for years, look who's handling this. Look who's doing this. This is not, this is something that they can understand and they can relate to, because they can see, well, that really should be health. That really should be the CDC, or that really should be our equivalent over here. I'm not sure what our equivalent is, Sage. Oh, we got two. The thing about Britain as well, we've got a country which is always going to be divided. The north and south of England are two completely different places with different genetics. If you go back through the actual ethnicity of people, they are separate people, and that comes out very much in their relationship. The north and the south of England do not get on through stereotype, anyway, the stereotype of it, but it is true in many cases that the northerners see the southerners as wet southerners, and the southerners see the northerners as stupid northerners, and they treat each other like that in like their actions. And then you've got Scotland, which is separate again, and it's kind of separate government, even though it's part of the United Kingdom. And I'm in Wales, where we got the Welsh Assembly, but it doesn't really have any powers, and it has enough powers to ban books and sanitary towels during this. But that's what it does. It only uses the powers it can have, and it's like, well, we can't do anything about tax, so we may as well ban sanitary towels. And in Wales itself, Wales is a really interesting example of where we're all separate tribes, really. West Wales is different from South Wales, which is different from North Wales, which is borderline Wales, and which is different from North Pembrokeshire. They're all from separate tribes, separate ethnicities, and we're a very fractured country. That's why we weren't able to hold off the annexation by Henry VIII of I think it was the eighth, the annexation of Wales. We couldn't stop that because we were too divided. We were always been a house divided because we're separate people. We're like five tribes of Wales, really. So the whole country is split. The whole country is teetering on independence. It's been the first time ever that people have been talking about Welsh independence, apart from me and a couple other people. It's been a joke before, and now it's being seen as a potential way to get away from all of these crazy rules in London. But what people are also starting to see now is that our rules are as crazy. If we give the option to our government to do it, they're going to ban books and sanitary towels.
I mean, right? I've heard something similar from Scots, right? Who are like, well, we'd like independence, but Nicola Sturgeon is so insane.
Yeah.
That we don't really know if we want it, if she's the one in charge.
Precisely, because all of these governors are beholden to the bigger entities. Like, even if we're not in the EU, all our trade is with the EU, so much of our diplomacy is with the EU, so much of our science research is with the EU, that we are still beholden to them. We are still like connected and linked to them, and we won't get away with it. The Scottish people, I mean, they don't take crap from anybody. They are some of the toughest folk around. The people who are represented by Scotland on the BBC and the news are not Scottish people. I will say that quite openly, even though they sound Scottish, they're from Scotland, etc. They're all people who are like, they see it as a caste system. They see themselves as better than the normal Scots, because the Scottish people are a really fantastically, I mean, they don't take crap. They really don't. So they have a history of that. They have a history of fighting and beating much bigger armies and much bigger enemies and having no fear at all. And when I talk to Scottish people, I work with a Scottish lady, a woman who will never listen to this, but I'll give her a shout out, Lorraine. Oh, she's wonderful. She's a perfect example of Scottishness. She's like a small, strong woman who is so super tough and will say it as it is. So I can't see that last in places like Scotland. And this is the problem. The more they put in place their authoritarian rules, the more it breaks down in one section of our society in Britain and not another, and the more they don't listen in. We've got different rules all around the country now. So, I mean, it's not workable. People are really getting fed up with it. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of people, I see in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland especially, I would assume, because England's a very different entity, a very different type of like people there. They're henpecked. they're under the thumb very much more by Westminster than we are, because of course we see ourselves as different countries. Wales is a separate country, even though it's classed as a principality, where Prince Charles, Prince of the paedophiles, sorry, but Prince Charles is the one who's supposed to be our representative, like balls. He's as Welsh as the next Englishman, who doesn't understand really our country and our people. And there's a lot of division in this country, and it will keep going that way. Over the next 10 years, we will see fights for independence for Scotland and independence for Wales, and probably reunification of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And this is all down to the fact that the Westminster has been running us badly for the entirety of our histories.
Well, something I wanted to touch on that you sort of mentioned a little bit earlier was sort of the lumping together of the intelligence-driven technocratic push and healthcare, right? And I know that you mm-hmm. have written, well, I've been writing about it on the US side, but you've written quite a bit about it on the UK side of things. Would you be able to sort of give a little summary of that, if you wish?
Well, the one problem is, if I mention one woman's name, NJ, if I mention her name out loud, then there will be court action within a week and a half to 2 weeks in mainland Europe to take this down, and they will use every dirty, sinister trick in the book. But basically, there's a lot of entities who are connected with... and you can find my work at johnnyfedmore.com, or you can find my work about openly on other places. I'm not hiding what her name is, and just every single time I've talked about her, apart from one, has been deleted from the internet so far. So I don't like to have our podcast deleted so quickly, even though it may be censored due to the fact it's about the most sensitive subject, which is the vaccines. I mean, that's the most sensitive. But basically, there's a lot of entities connected to different intelligence communities, heavily Israeli involved. There's a lot of Israeli unit 8,200 people, and people who are connected to them, people who are connected to the Council, European Council on Foreign Relations, people who are connected to the MI5, etc., who are all entering in or have entered in within the past five to eight years, I'd say, into the technological medical world. People like Daniel Korsky, who was the head of the health tech advisory, or at least set up the health tech advisory board with Matt Hancock, the minister for health, or secretary for health. It's hard because I do you know, both research in America and Britain, and sometimes I can never remember the titles.
Well, there's a lot of titles and a lot of acronyms, and it can get intense after a while. I feel your pain.
It does. These people are basically working to completely and utterly dominate the coming technological revolution that's going to happen in healthcare and medicine that we see happening in front of us in very real time, especially with an example right. like the mRNA vaccine. This is the step towards this new future. What was really interesting is there is a lot of similarities between medical treatments and the evolution of medical treatments at the moment, that kind of like smell of transhumanism alongside AI happening at the same time, that of course smells of transhumanism in a different way. One's a biological transhumanism and one's like a cyber transhumanism or a technological transhumanism. Now these two groups have met and coalesced and married in the middle. All of these people are linked in with each other. They're all one step away from all of the actors that we see working very hard, people from Trudeau and Macron and people like that, to change the world of medicine in their image. But really, if you look at it, it's the intelligence community who are on the forefront of occupying mm-hmm. all of these positions of power. This is, there will be a story I'm writing at the moment that it's very complicated, very major research, because they are creating that infrastructure now to keep us tied down and keep us suppressed, keep us in a subjugated situations, and to make it worse, there's people like Peter Thiel and Palantir, of course, as you've talked about, programs like that are an infrastructure that's being created so that one day that they can get rid of the accountability of government. These things, these technocrats or because it's a technopoly rather than it's a technocracy. You know, these people are all linked with big companies who all got big money. They're all mm-hmm. working for certain entities. It's all about money, 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 money. It's also about power, 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 power. They're all trying to create something that means that they have the infrastructure that if government was to be pulled away, they would be in control. So it's like creating the complete network of control underneath. Now, the best way to do that is be in charge of medicine, to be in charge of the future tech, which will be in every part of our life, and have the ability to train AI or ask their AI to watch everybody, to see everybody. to encourage the public to start putting wristbands on so that they can monitor their health from a distance and they don't have to worry about it anymore. Someone else will be doing that for them. But that comes along with loads of other things.
Well, that, oddly enough, is not that far away, at least for the US, because as I wrote about, probably a few weeks ago, Operation Warp Speed, one of the least reported facets about it, but one that's openly admitted by the head of that whole operation, Moncef Salawi, is that everyone that gets the vaccine, they haven't said how yet, but if you look at the people involved in Warp Speed, there are some ideas, but they say that there will be a very precise surveillance system. He sometimes calls it a tracking system. Sometimes he calls it a pharmacovigilance system that will be used to monitor everyone that gets the initial dose of the vaccine to make sure they come back for the second dose, because Pfizer's vaccine, as well as a lot of the other vaccine candidates, are multi-dose vaccines, but not only that, but to monitor those people for adverse side effects to the vaccine after it's already been injected into people, which is really quite nuts. So basically, you know, the people that are getting the vaccine or will receive the vaccine will be guinea pigs themselves, really, and are going to be monitored to see what would happen. And it's most likely that it will either be through this thing called Profusa that was developed by DARPA, was actually developed under a program, former DARPA program manager named Matt Hepburn, who is actually now the go-to vaccine coordinator for Operation Warp Speed. And he is definitely that mad scientist archetype. That would be him. I would recommend people go and watch his TED Talks. They're very unsettling. I'll just leave it at that. But in addition, one of the main third-party entities involved in Operation Warp Speed, called ATI, or Advanced Technology International, at the same time they were issuing the contracts to vaccine companies on behalf of Warp Speed, they were also soliciting bids to create a wearable that would detect a lot of these same things and things like that. So it's very possible that what was once a voluntary fitness device may not be so voluntary for this quote-unquote extremely precise, as Moncef Salawi calls it, pharmacovigilance surveillance system that people that receive the Operation Warp Speed vaccine will be apparently subjected to make sure they're not naughty and miss that second dose and whatever happens next, right?
That pharmacovigilance, that's a beautiful term. That's
I'm sure that came straight out of the boardrooms of McKinsey.
I don't know. That came straight out of the desk of George Orwell himself. I mean, that's a fantastic way to they manipulate language nowadays. They create all sorts of terms that really just mean different forms.
Well, what's even nuttier, right, is that the company is managing that for Warp Speed. It's not the government that manages that. It's going to be Google and it's going to be Oracle. Both of those companies have very deep ties. Well, Oracle's case, they have very close ties to Israeli intelligence, but also the CIA. And then Google, of course, has very close ties to the entire U.S. national security state and was originally funded by InQtel and Eric Schmidt, of course, the former CEO, intimately involved in AI policy for the national security state of the U.S. So quite nuts.
Well, I think you'll see them start to, and you're already seeing them start to utilize excuses that will mean that the army can be involved. So to make this track and tracing process much more efficient and professional, make it military. So this idea that the Moderna vaccine. Woo, slip of the tongue.
it's all right.
the Moderna vaccine. Well, that needs to be stored at -20 degrees, and the Pfizer vaccine needs to be stored at -70 degrees. So, in talking about that, they've also talked about the military being involved in distribution to make sure that everything is kept at certain temperatures, etc. But that I see as a setting up of having specialist supervisors put this sort of technology into action, this track and trace technology, which is, because I mean, when I wrote the Daniel Korsky article and was looking at his Panopticon technology, that's really what that was about. They had a guy from the alcohol systems detection systems, I guess them, where they've had the tag that goes around drinkers' legs for ages that can tell if they've had a drink. You know, they test for chemical reactions that drink has that comes out in the sweat. And I think that's what we're looking at in the future. I think we're looking at no one needing to go to have a COVID-19 test because they'll conveniently say, oh, you've got COVID-19 because your little band tells you you've got COVID-19. Mm-hmm.
They're already developing that. The military is in the US anyway, mm-hmm. for several months now.
That's why I think underground, hidden away, there's a race to these other technologies that are going alongside. In the sense, they're evangelist technologies. They're people who have to get companies to create parts of them before they can actually make their vision come true. So they need the software, they need the things built, and they need so they're going through that process behind the scenes right now, in my opinion, to create something that's like that. And there's a race on for the wearable that will do everything, and I think. I personally, and this is only my personal opinion, I think that's what Panopticon Technology was set up to do, was to try and find how to mix in this cybersecurity wearable technology, dystopian future, the Internet of Things generation, and put them all into one thing so that they can press a button and hear you whenever they want to. I don't want to be too far-fetched with
I don't think you are at all. I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it sounds far-fetched. I mean, it sounds naturally to us when we hear things like that. We then think of the ridicule that Kellyanne Conway or Donald Trump would have got when they said, oh, eventually your microwave will be able to listen to you. Eventually your microwave will be able to listen to you. And it's really, really...
Well, a former CIA director, David Petraeus, is known in the US for saying that they'll use your kitchen appliances to spy on you. He said this several years ago and people were like, and everyone forgot, and here it is now.
Yeah, because the Internet of Things, this thing is it's a prison. It's a digital prison. It wouldn't be if it was made by normal people, and if it was designed to help humanity and people in general population, general people working every day. If the Internet of Things was put into place to help these people, it would be a wonderful technology. But they've seen that if they set it up themselves, the intelligence agencies themselves will have full control of every single appliance.
What alarms me now is that they're not just talking about the Internet of Things. There's this new bit that they're throwing around called the Internet of Bodies, which has to do with the whole wearable bit and everything related to that. And I wanted to bring this up earlier when you were talking about the surveillance capabilities of these things. Amazon is probably a latecomer to the whole fitness wearable market. Theirs recently came out a month or two ago. I forget exactly what it's called, but basically it has two microphones, and one of the ones that listens to you, it doesn't only just like, you know, it does a lot of creepy things. It makes like a 3D model of your body in your underwear and all of this stuff.
Oh, nice.
You know, to motivate you to be fit, I suppose. But what it also does is that it listens to your voice and picks up on your emotions and notes at what times during the day you sound sad or depressed and when you sound happy and whatever. And, you know, it's very interesting that right before this, Amazon bought up some sort of online pharmacy company. And so, you know, it definitely seems like the future of, oh, you sound sad today. Here are some antidepressants Amazon is sending to you in the mail. You know, that type of
here's
future.
Here's a little bit of Soma. Like, we'll inject just a little bit of, ooh, that's a boost.
Inject a little bit of hope, as Matt Hancock has been saying.
Yeah, thank you, Matt Hancock. Thank you for injecting that happiness into my arm. I mean, that idea of injecting happiness into people, that's so far removed from the childhood I got brought up, where intravenous injections are like the last state of affairs, like in most things. Like, if someone's injecting something into you, you're in trouble.
Yes, well, now it's forcible hope injections.
But this is what I was going to say. That's something else I was going to say, is that Matt Hancock is like, he enjoys gaslighting people. When he says these things, he puts on his very straight face where he doesn't move his lips at all.
But you can kind of tell he likes to gaslight, though. I think you're right about that.
He loves it. He loves it because he knows that if he works to the stereotypes, it increases a conspiracy happening, or of this sort of lackadaisical approach. I don't know what you'd call it, but the use of his terminology and etc. Well, that's he's laughing at us. He's laughing at us quite hard because he knows that whatever happens, it'll be fine for him. Or he is making enough money from all of this. I think he's got investments in some of this stuff too. All of the people involved in making the decisions have got some sort of
investment. Oh, yeah. Monsef Salawi, the head of Warp Speed, was allowed to keep and make new investments in pharmaceutical and bioelectronic medicine companies and all of this stuff. Why this year's been going on, which is quite scandalous. Normally would not happen.
Patrick Vallance, who's a head scientific advisor over in the UK, he has I think it's hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of GlaxoSmithKline shares for his time when he was in GlaxoSmithKline. So they're all still able to benefit and then look at you and say, "Oh no, we're independent." I don't understand how is not heads rolling. I know that's I'm not suggesting that people do that because I don't think the guillotine's the answer to anything. Well, not everything, but the guillotine isn't the answer to most things. I can't believe that people haven't risen up. And it's true when they say things like in our country, they're saying you're not allowed to sleep with your partner and you should wear masks in bed. I can't believe that people haven't pulled
the glory hole suggestion for intercourse. I think some health authority said that in the West. I can't remember if it was a US person or a UK person or where it was, but it's quite nuts.
Sorry, I don't know what a glory hole is.
Okay, well I'll leave you to your
I'm only joking.
Oh, okay. All right, whoops. Okay, well maybe that's a good time to to end the episode, because we have covered a lot of ground, I suppose, and we are at the usual time for ending these things. So thank you so much for being here to talk about Pfizer and politics and the growing public health panopticon.
Thank you for having me. It's a wonderful experience to be on your podcast. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you all to all our listeners, and catch you next time.